I'm talking about culture this morning and how it's unavoidable. I want to start off with this little quiz, just whatever comes to your mind. You see this up here at the top of the board? It's a ring of stars, 13 of them actually, five-pointed stars. It's got the number 1776 in the middle of it. If you were driving down the road, I'm looking more at the boys than the girls here because there may be a quicker association with it, but I don't know. If you're driving down the road and you see this window sticker, kind of a frosted window sticker on the back of a vehicle like this, maybe this big, what kind of vehicle would you expect to see it on? Somebody, just pop it out. Jacked up truck. What? Yeah, big diesel pickup. Okay, great. So does this person, let's just guess. Do you think this person is for outlawing guns, or do you think they're pro-gun? Pro-gun. Did they vote in the last election? For who? Biden? No, it wasn't Biden. Sorry, it was... Yeah, so they voted for Trump. Oh, that's interesting. If you had to pin them down on pro-life versus abortion, where do you think they'd come out? Pro-life, probably. Well, that's really interesting, because all as we know about this person, really from what we have on the board, is just a ring of stars and a number, a four-digit number in the middle of it. Hi, you are so sure of yourselves. And what's funny is I ran this same simulation in a meeting at CAM with just some of my small team. I'm like, hey, look at this window sticker. What do you think? And I ask the same questions to get the same answers. You're 7 hours away. They come off with all the same answers. That's culture. You have a subculture built around an idea. This is simply symbolic of an idea. And you have this culture that's built around that. And you can identify all these things about this person because of the culture they're part of. And one of the things that really bothered me, and has been bothering me, is the way I'll hear people say, oh, that's just culture. Like, wait a minute, just culture? It's like saying, yeah, we had an explosion go off in the basement. It was just a nuclear weapon. A culture is not just. It's one of the most powerful shaping influences we will experience in our lives, whether we acknowledge it or not. And there's absolutely no way to avoid it. Now I'm going to take you out a little bit further. In fact, I'm not sure I'm going to even make you name this one. It's another bumper sticker. Does that mean anything to you? Would you put it on your car? It's two hearts, right? Oh, there's some zany colors going on there, right? Did any of you here in the front row drive, have your own car out here? You did? You have your car out here? So if I went and put this on the back of your car, would you leave it there or take it off? Like next year, next week, before you... Wow. Yeah. I agree with you. This means something. It's part of a culture. And this brother over here recognizes that it's part of a culture, and we also see something else coming out of him that we can appreciate. He does not, under any circumstance, want to be associated with that culture. Period. He's taking it off before he leaves the parking lot. He is not driving that car down the road with that bumper sticker on it, and it doesn't say anything. There's no words. Just some colors and shapes. That's culture. And he's saying, no, I'm not going to be identified with that culture. Isn't that what you're saying? Yep. Absolutely. Now, I'm going to take you on a little bit of a dark journey here. And I feel almost bad doing this because it's a little cruel. It's also, unfortunately, accurate for too many people that I know, people that I grew up with. So imagine this scene. Just, you don't have to close your eyes, whatever. Just think through this. You're in a darkened room 30 years from now. There's a TV running. There's some crumpled cans on the floor. And your phone pings. And it's your lawyer. And he's trying to reach settlement with your third spouse. It pings again, and it's your second spouse texting to say it's your turn to take care of Junior this weekend. And thinking about Junior makes you think about your family reunion. You think about your family and the families you actually have. Should you go? It seems important, kind of, to go see your dad because your mom's gone now, and she's died. But you kind of expect that your sibling spouses don't feel very comfortable around you. And your siblings are probably all warning their children and your nieces and nephews, and they're using you as a bad example, how not to turn out. Because it's actually almost easier to just sit here and watch stale TV shows than to face the pain of all that. So you slouch back in your chair and you click through a couple channels, but it's all boring, but it beats texting your ex-spouse back or your lawyer. So as your eyes drift from the phone to the crumpled can on the floor to the blaring TV, you wonder, how did I get here? Because this is you, remember? You're sitting here now. This is 30 years from now. And you remember playing with your cousins on your grandpa's lawn at family reunions, something your own children, they're never going to have. Swinging on the tire swing, playing in the creek, it all seems like it happened to another person. How did you get here? Well, one thing we can be sure of, culture had a powerful role to play in it. We'll come back to this later. I was sitting with one of my non-Anabaptist friends. He spent a lot of time in and out of our communities, and he likes a lot of things about our Anabaptist communities, but he's not willing to commit. And he thinks we're not quite doctrinally sound. He's more, he would be more... maybe Dutch Reform in his thinking. And we were sitting up one night talking, because we're friends, and I told him the church I'm part of now requires that the people we use up front have to have a beard. And he said, that is so judgmental. That is just, that's so judgmental. Now, think about this. If our church was claiming that you had to have a beard to be a Christian, that would be really bizarre. I think we can all agree on that, right? That would be bizarre. That would be really strange. And the church I grew up with all my life before I went out to Ohio didn't require beards, and so I didn't have one. So I most of my life without a beard, and now I'm part of a church that has a beard, so I have a beard. But it would be really bizarre if that's what we were claiming, that you have to have one to be a Christian. And it seemed like maybe that was the underlying thing. Oh, you're just being so judgmental. And I said, Ben, we're not claiming you have to have a beard to be a Christian. But here's the thing. You're going to be part of a culture. You will be. Period. I don't know if I said it to him quite like that. I'm saying it to you. But we're all going to be part of a culture. You can't not be part of a culture. You can't say, hey, let's do this. You be that kind of culture. You're Anabaptist, and you're Anabaptist, and I don't do culture. It's ludicrous. No rational person, having seriously thought through the subject, would propose that you could be cultureless. Not any group of people for any period of time, because even if you had a group of people that were claiming that and they got together, they would have their own culture. Culture is just whatever you are. It's whatever the group norms are. So it's completely unavoidable. I said, Ben, what makes more sense to you? A group of Christian brethren sitting down, praying together, and thoughtfully choosing our cultural norms in a way that lines up with what we believe, simplicity, modesty, not drawing attention to yourself. Does that make more sense to you? Or does let Hollywood set all those norms for you make more sense to you? Because it's going to really be one or the other. Now, that's a little bit of an oversimplification. You could be drawn towards a hippie culture or God forbid, you know, some other culture. But you will be part of a culture. And so you're either going to be part of a Christian culture that sits down and says, what do we really believe about vehicles, about dress, about all these things? And then thoughtfully sets cultural norms according that line up with our belief system. And no, we can't point at every single thing we do and say, there's a Bible verse for this. Nobody else in the world can do that either. But you can build a lifestyle that's in synchrony with the Bible. Or you can let general society decide for you, and you end up with a culture that most definitely isn't in synchrony with the Bible. But you can't be cultureless. You will be guided by culture. That is a given. One of the sayings, you know, sometimes, maybe it's just me, but sometimes a saying will get into your life, a statement or a saying, a quote, and it becomes a major part of your life. You keep going back to it and looking at it and saying, I still believe that. This is still true. And there's this really, I don't have the quote 100%. I think it was actually a scientist that said it, Nobel Prize winning scientist. But it went something like this. He said, it's important not to deceive others. And it's important not to deceive ourselves. Keeping in mind that the person most easily deceived is ourself. We are the easiest person to lie to from ourselves. We can lie to ourselves better than anybody else. We are better at lying to ourselves than anybody else. Have you ever heard someone say something like this? What? That doesn't mean anything. I mean, no. I just like this color. I like this way of combing my hair, and I like this hat. You might even believe this stuff if you're not very introspective. You might actually think it's true. Now, I'm going to take you on a bit of a radical example. So I grew up in the American South and have enjoyed elements of the Southern black culture. But let's say I would go to the American South into a black community, peacefully going about their business, and I would take a sheet, and I'd cut some eye holes in it, and I'd put it over my head, and I'd walk down the street with this sheet over my head and these eye holes and looking out at the world. And someone would say, hey, what are you doing that for? You say, look, man, it's okay. I just really like wearing a sheet. It's just my thing. Or what if you would go to a reunion of Holocaust survivors, and you're dressed up and you strut in there, duck walking in heavy jack boots, and you're dressed like a Nazi SF officer. And someone would say, well, what are you doing? I just really like walking like this, and I like jack boots, and I like black. You think people would be like, oh yeah, cool. If that's your thing, no problem, man. Sure. No, they wouldn't. People would be outraged. And they'd be outraged for good reason. Because the black community has been terrorized, unjustly terrorized, by Ku Klux Klan members wearing sheets over their head. And the Jews have been horribly abused by duck-walking, jackboot-wearing SS officers. They have been. That's a historic fact. And they would immediately recognize something that we so often wish to avoid recognizing. When you dress like a group of people, you're not only dressing like them, but you're showing that you sympathize with them, and not just with them as people, but with the ideologies that drive them. And in the case of both the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazis, they both have horrible evil ideologies, and this has caused them to commit horrible evil things on their fellow humans. And we recognize that immediately. So I don't want to dress like or act like a Ku Klux Klan member or a Nazi because I don't want anybody to think that I in any way have any affiliation or sympathy with these evil movements or ideologies. I simply don't want anybody to think I have anything to do with it. Just like this brother over here said, that sticker's not staying on my car. Absolutely not. I'm going to leave in the parking lot. I don't want anybody to think that I have any sympathy or affiliation with this ideology. But how often do we see Anabaptist youth dressing like some sports hero or a musician or an NBA player, and they just say, no, I just really like this hat or this kind of shirt or these shoes. It's important not to lie to others. And it's important not to lie to ourselves, keeping in mind the person most easily lied to is ourself. The great truth is we don't like things. We like what we look up to or are trying to emulate. It's a universal human truth, I think. We always try to be like what we admire And so if you see an Anabaptist youth, and I actually had one in mind, with a 17 with this sticker, the 1776 sticker on his truck window, what does that tell me about his thinking and his leaning and his desires of this Anabaptist youth? We already talked about that, right? Tells us a lot. We talked about this. If I put this on my car, would you ride in my car with me? You don't want to be caught dead riding around in a car with that, in a car with that on it, even if it's not your car. Culture is about identity. It's who we are. This is why when we see someone join the volunteer fire department, they may very soon come out with a window sticker that looks something like this. You know, it has the ladder and it has the fire hydrant and it says volunteer fire department. So you see this volunteer fire department sticker show up on their truck window. They're proclaiming it's not just something they do. It's who they are. They're not just a person who occasionally helps put out fires. They are fireman. Fire person, if they're a lady. It's not just firefighters. Someone starts scuba diving. And the next thing you know, they have one of those red license plates on the front of their car that has a white diagonal bar across it. You've seen them. Some of you may not know what they are, scuba diving. Someone starts working on their pilot's license, and the next thing you know, they have an AOPA sticker on their truck or an EAA logo on their hat or jacket or maybe a bumper sticker that says, I'd rather be flying. I'm not making judgment calls necessarily on any of these things. I'm saying this is how humans act. All normal humans identify with things. Someone gets into off-road culture, and next thing you know, their car, their Honda Accord, has a license plate frame around it that says, my other ride is a Jeep. These people are making statements about who they are, what they admire, what they wish to be, and what they want to be identified with. This is true across cultures, I think across the centuries of time and across the borders of nations. This is how normal people act. It's part of being essentially human. We recognize there are people who have mental handicaps that don't allow them to read social situations and cultures and doesn't allow them to interact in normal ways with culture. And we're not making fun of that here. But we all recognize when we see that, that it's not normal human behavior, that it's a handicap. It's not something we want in our life. And yet we'll see somebody who says, I don't care what anybody thinks. Just do my own thing. You can be sure he's lying. He may be lying to himself, but he is lying. Remember, the important thing is not to deceive others, and it's important not to deceive ourselves, keeping in mind the person most easily deceived is ourself. So if you walk up to a friend at a ball game and he has on this jacket, and it's a nice gray jacket, but you look at it a little closer, you notice it has this logo of a very well-known tactical wear company. Makes a lot of, you know, maybe clothes for paramilitary and that sort of thing. And you say, hey, that's a tactical brand. Do you like their stuff? And he said, I just like their jackets. They make great stuff, you know, ripstop, nylon, tough clothes, that sort of thing. Do you believe them? And that's a judgment call you get to make. Does he just like their stuff? Okay, let's turn the situation around. Let's say you see your bishop wearing this tactical jacket. And now here's something you know about your bishop. He's simple, he's godly, and he's known for being exceptionally gentle with everybody. And you walk up to him and you say, hey, I see you're wearing a tactical jacket. And what he'd likely do? Give you a blank look and say, my wife bought this at $2 at the Share and Care. Right? That's a likely outcome. Of what? And he'd say, well, what? What is it? It's a what? The tactical? And you say, oh, it's just a clothes company that's known for making high-end clothes for paramilitary and tactical, you know, police type. And he might just chuckle and say, I had no idea. But what's likely to happen next? Maybe he keeps wearing the jacket. But somehow, it ends up being his barn jacket when he wears out and does the chores with. Why? Well, it's not just because he doesn't want to be a bad testimony or lead youth astray or anything like that. It's because he's a gentle, peace-loving person. And the idea of going out in public with garments that portray and glorify violence would make him uncomfortable. It would make him uncomfortable because it's not who he is. He simply doesn't want to be identified with that tactical culture any more than I want to be identified with the Ku Klux Klan or the Nazis. Or a brother over here wants to be identified with this. It's not a value system he can identify with, and he doesn't want to be identified with it. So he just uses it as a barn jacket from then on. I'm not saying we need to know everything about every manufacturer and what we wear and what company we use and every product. When we have our minds set on heaven and we truly want to be identified with plain, simple, and godly group, we'll do things that identify us with plain, simple, and godly group. And even if we get something wrong, as in the case of your gentle bishop wearing a tactical jacket, it's glaringly obvious that it was unintentional because it doesn't fit with anything else they're doing. Because things, culture tends to run in packages, tends to come in packages. That's how culture works. And when I see things that when you see some things that suddenly look out of place, like your bishop wearing a tactical jacket, you can chuckle and have a pretty good idea that he's just clueless about it. And that's perfectly fine. It's not a statement about his identity. But if I see a young man and he has a tactical jacket and he has an AR-15 under his seat and he has a 1776 bumper sticker on his truck window, we know an awful lot about him actually now. We know how he sees himself and what he admires. Now, you think I'm going down this road where a person should be told, here, you got to get rid of the AR, you got to get rid of the jacket, you got to get rid of the window sticker. And there could be a case made for that, actually. But the primary truth here is that whether anybody calls him out on it or not, whether anybody raises a fuss or not, it's still a value system and a statement about who he is. It's part of his fundamental chosen identity. And it doesn't get much more serious than that. I want to tell you a story about one of my nephews. He was I just called him this morning. I knew about this story, but I never heard him tell it. So I called him this morning and I said, hey, tell me this story. So he did, and he added details to it I didn't know. And he said, you're welcome to use this story. One of my nephews was he's a short distance truck driver, so he's hauling mini barns and he's out on the road all the time. And so he's listening to audiobooks. And he was listening to a particular kind of story, you know, the shoot-em-up western, whatever, Chick Baudry, two guns tied low, whatever, the fast gunman. This is what he was listening to, and he told me this morning, he said, the bigger the gunfight, the faster the draw, that's what got me going. But he had guns of his own, and he's probably was buying more guns, and he started playing around with this whole fast draw thing. And then he bought a speed timer, shooting speed timer, where you set it, and it has a timer, and it has a light on it. So you stand in front of your target with your hands on your gun belt, your gun in your holster, facing the target, and you're watching the light with your hands not on your gun, just resting on your gun belt. When the light comes on, you snatch your gun out and you shoot the target. And when the gun goes off, the timer stops. So light on, gunshot, timer stops. And you look at the timer and you're like, no, that was 0.623 of a second. No, just over half a second. Yeah. And he said over the course of about a year, he got to where he could hang, they hung a rug up. And they would attach these 12-gauge shotgun shells to it for targets. And he would stand back 12 feet, set the timer, hands on your gun belt. He said he got to the place over the course of about a year that when the light came on, he could draw, shoot, and hit one of those shotgun shells on the rug in about half a second. An elite shooter could probably do it a lot faster than that. But half a second from your hands resting on your gun belt, they're not touching the gun, and hit the target, the shotgun shell on the target. One day, So he's feeding his mind with this continual rubbish of the fast gun and the big gunfights, and he's doing this. He's training his mind. He's training his body. He's training his mind. He's training his body. He's becoming part of this culture that he admires. He brought the culture into himself. Now he's becoming it. One day he was out riding his horse, and there were several of them were riding their horses together. He was in the lead. And have you ever been riding or walking even, and a pheasant or a quail just blows up right at your feet? Scares you back to the 12th century. It wasn't a pheasant or a quail. It was a turkey. And it blew up right in front of his horse. And he shot the turkey just like that. There was no conscious thought. There was no decision. He shot it. He said the only thing that saved the turkey was that he happened to have a rat shot. They had a rat shot load under in the gun. And they're not lethal past about 20 feet. But he said he hit it. He knocked a feather off it. He said he dead-centered it. If it had been a slug, that would have been it. He never thought about it. There was no conscious decision. He just did it. That got him thinking. He said, what if it had been a person? Because here's somebody who's claiming to be a non-resistant Christian, who's part of a Mennonite church, a conservative Mennonite church. And he's toying with this culture, this other culture. He's got pieces of it, and then he gets more pieces of it. Now he's got a pretty nice pile of this culture in his life. And all of a sudden, he looked at it, and he's like, that is not who I want to be. And so he pushed back on this stuff, pushed it away from him. He just told me that story this morning. When you enter into a culture, tends to begin making a lot of decisions for you that you didn't even know you were going to make. That's the way culture always works. Now, I said a few minutes ago you can make a case for this boy having to get rid of this jacket or the sticker or the AR. And you're probably thinking, okay, here it comes. Now he's going to hit me over the head with some nasty judgmental argument for rigid church standards. I think you can make that case, actually, but not today. I'd rather tell you a couple really interesting experiments. They took this group of people and they randomly divided them into two groups. And the test they were going to take in the lab was to show how willing they were to help other people and sympathy, things like that, compassion. But they said, okay, for this test you're going to be taking, it's important that all your street clothes be covered. You can't go in and take this test with any of your, your suit or whatever, your t-shirt, jeans. None of that can be showing. I'm like, okay, so what are we supposed to do? Well, we've got something you can put on. Well, so the one group, they gave them a bunch of nurse's scrubs. And yeah, it's really lucky this other department over here had a bunch of extra scrubs, and we'll let you wear those. That'll cover your clothes up. Okay, so they put them on and go and take the test. It might have been done individually, but it was still a group. And then the other group, they told the individuals, you got to have your street clothes covered. And look, we're psychologists. We're not seamstresses or anything. So we got these big balloonish kind of Ku Klux Klanish wearing things that you can just put over your head and you put your head through, but you hang down. And it might make you look a little Ku Klux Klanish, but hey, we're not seamstresses. Okay, we're psychologists. So your street clothes got to be covered. It's a rule. So they go in and they take the test. So between those dressed as nurses and those dressed like more like Klan members, who do you think scored the highest on compassion and willing to help their fellow men? One guess here. It's a nurses group. This was a randomly chosen group of people. They did not choose what they got to wear. They were told a lie about what they had to put on. It wasn't their choice at all. It just was what the researchers told them they had to wear. And it still affected their behavior. It's fascinating to me. They didn't know the way they had to dress had anything to do with the test. It appears that the subconscious mind looks around and says, hey, I'm dressed like a nurse. How would a nurse act in this situation? And that subtle clue was enough to drive a change in behavior. And the opposite was also true for the other group. So sometimes people say, window stickers, vehicles, clothes, purses. They're just culture, just clothes, just stuff. They don't really matter. We're talking about being a Christian here. Well, the social psychologists know this isn't true. Even apart from any religious background or religious or cultural mandate, the way people dress says a great deal about who they are as a person, and it potentially even affects our behavior in real time, every day, our behavior slightly modifying depending on what we choose to put on that day. It just bends my mind. So social science know that some of these things are true of humans, and we're humans. Might be true for the rest of us too, right? That was another interesting study. I won't get into it as deep, but they took a group and they divided them into two groups. You on this side are going to be prison guards. You on this side are going to be prisoners. Okay? So they show up at the prisoner's house one morning, drag them out of their bed, handcuff them, bring them to this makeshift prison they built in a basement. And, okay, you all get uniforms. You put on these big mirror sunglasses. You put on these crisp uniforms. You're going to make sure they behave. In just a few days, the guards were acting like guards and the prisoners were acting like prisoners, which is amazing, isn't it? Because most times prisoners are carefully selected out of society as a criminal element. And we just selected them out of society. And we may have just selected them out of society as non-criminals. But all of a sudden, the roles are kicking in. And what happened is the guards started treating the prisoners, which were their fellow people being experimented on, so brutally, the experiment had to be stopped. And I think one of the guards afterwards said, you know, that really shook me up. He said, I didn't know I had it in me to be that cruel. Maybe it didn't. Until you put him in a pair of mirror sunglasses and tactical clothes. I'm not going to say any more here this moment about churches needing to set guidelines. Why? Because as one of my friends or acquaintances used to say, a word to the wise is sufficient. Now, I want to think about another situation. I'm not going to give you an answer for it, I don't believe. But I want you to think about it, and I want you to go home and think about it. So you have this, people enthusiastically copy each other in a healthy group. You may resent that.
Oh, not me.
It's healthy, normal human dynamics. So let's say you have this group, and for the sake of our discussion, it's a church. And just for the sake of our discussion, we've been talking about the boys a lot. It's a group of ladies. And all these ladies are dressing a lot the same, kind of enthusiastically copying each other, and there may be a set of standards, and there should be, that's guiding that. And everybody's kind of dressing like everybody else, and they all put their little tweak on it, and ladies are really good about that. And then three of them in this group, for some reason, in this church community, all of a sudden change to a different style of whatever, hairstyle, dress pattern, whatever, just fill in the blank. And then you notice that one of the girls in this threesome that's now doing things different than the rest of the church recently visited her cousin at another church, and you look over at that other church, and that's how they do it over there. What's going on here? You know, we could easily get lost in the weeds with protracted arguments about which style is better than which. But I wonder if something more fundamental isn't happening. For some reason, these three have stopped identifying, have disidentified themselves from the group they're accountable to, and are now identifying with another group that they're not accountable to. Why? Well, we could speculate, or I might give you thoughts. I think I'll just leave that question with all of you. Just leave it right there. Why would they do that? What does it say about their identity in the group that they claim to belong to and their accountability to the group they claim to belong to? Just leave it there. This There's another thing that really bent my mind. There was a study done, and it found that if the one person in a group of friends became obese, really overweight, more, the chance of any other or all other members of that group becoming obese increases, even if they don't all live in the same state. Why? I mean, I could see if me and three of my friends are going out to the greasy pizza joint five nights a week after work, that if my friend sitting right beside me in the booth is becoming overweight, that, yeah, I'm eating the same pizza tray he is. Yeah, there's at least a possibility that I might start looking that way, right? Okay. But across state lines, they're not even eating together. What is going on? It actually, once again, seems to have to do with culture and identity, with group culture. If one member of a group becomes obese and that's accepted by the group, then the group becomes a type of group, friend group, and the members a type of members of that group, that it's okay in this group to be that way. It appears that when we accept things for our friends, we subconsciously accept that option for ourselves, or at least the possibility of that option for ourselves. This isn't just about eating. In fact, it has all kinds of ramifications for situations that don't have anything to do with food. If one of the friends in a friend group leaves his wife and remarries, but you still accept him as your friend, still go out to eat with him, will that have any impact on your view of the sanctity of marriage? Does it, in fact, already say something about your view of the sanctity of marriage? Let's take a really extreme example to clarify. Let's say in this group of, let's say you're all friends, this group of friends here, some of you may have just met this weekend, but we'll just assume for argument you're all longtime friends. One of these boys, these brethren, goes out and kills seven people, and then he gets a presidential pardon, and he's free. It's all unlikely, but I'm building a case. You just accept him into your group and you go on. No big deal. What does that say about your view of the sanctity of life? I'm not talking about somebody who repents and there's a clear change of life. Does it say anything about your view of the sanctity of human life? Yes, it does. And it will also affect your view of the sanctity of life. Just like the study that shows where in a group of friends, if one friend gets obese, the chance that the others will be too. For this, there's an elevated chance that the others will be too. For the same reason, which is when a behavior becomes accepted by a member of a group or a culture, it becomes accepted by all that are in that group or culture, at least as a possibility. Why else would we see the staggering divorce rate we see in the Protestant churches? Well, for one, if it's okay for one of the group to do it, then it's okay for all the members of the group to do it. And this group is now the sort of group that allows for this sort of thing. It's who the group is, and it represents what the members of the group who the members of the group culture are and what they believe. Even if this wasn't true yesterday, it's true now because they've accepted it now. Culture does have that kind of power. It has the power to decide most of our day-to-day decisions by setting the acceptable versus unacceptable boundaries for those decisions. Because it has the power to decide most of our day-to-day decisions, it also has the power to decide our eternal destinies. It's that serious, which is why when we hear somebody say, oh, it's just culture, we can be sure they have no idea what they're talking about. They have no idea about the power of culture. I have a friend who's a non-Anabaptist and he wants to get married. Okay? So he came to me for advice, and he's bringing me these papers, and it was maybe two or three papers deep, and it has all these ideals on it for marriage and all that. Hey, that's fine. You should have ideals. That's great. But he doesn't really want to join our churches. And I looked over the bottom. He gave me the paper. What do you think about this? And I kind of glanced over him, and I said, well, here's the problem. I don't know what the divorce rate is in your group, the group he was part of, but they do have one. Let's say it's 25%, just for argument. 25% of the couples get divorced or remarried. If you remain part of this group, you're accepting the possibility that statistically you have a 25% chance of getting divorced and remarried. Is that acceptable to you? Our groups aren't perfect. They definitely aren't. But we do have an almost zero divorce and remarriage rate in our circles. I like that number. I really like that number. It's not just about me, and it's not just about my wife. It's about the incredible child abusive trauma that divorce puts on the children. That's a really harsh statement, but I think it's scientifically accurate. There's a lot of things I can put up with to be part of a culture that's going to keep me at a 0% divorce rate. After all, see, I could say to him, after all, this is part of your group and your group culture, and it allows for divorce. Why would you think you're going to be the statistical exception? Statistically, you're not going to be. You're going to be the rule. We all like to think we're the statistical exception, but we're not. It's self-deception. It's not how statistics work. You aren't the exception. Here's why it works this way, I think. We have ideals. He had ideals. That's great. We should have ideals. This friend of mine did. He had written them down. We should have ideals, and that's healthy. Do you always live up to your ideals? I can tell you, I don't. Just if this is a confession or whatever. When I'm sick, when I'm tired, when I'm discouraged, when I'm maybe just feeling rebellious, or just plain spiritually weak, I can mess my ideals by a pretty wide margin. Culture beats training. In moments of darkness, despair, and weakness, of which all of our lives have enough, you will fall to the level of your chosen culture's allowance, not fly at the level of your inspired belief or ideals. You'll fall to the level of your chosen culture's allowance. But you're the one choosing the culture, remember? Now, I want to go back to that scene at the beginning where I ask you to visualize this terribly broken scene. I put you through that. But I have cousins that are in situations similar to that. Like people who were raised in Anabaptist homes. People who sat in desks, you know, just two desks over from me. And we ask you to visualize this horrible scene, this mixed up marriage. It's irreparable. And I ask you to ask the question, because this is 30 years from now, how did I get here? How did I wind up here? Isn't that complicated? I started off by being discontented with where I was at. These people are too restrictive. They're too controlling. My parents are controlling. The ministry are picking on me. Whatever. You've heard all that before, right? And so I'm going to leave this culture because actually it's just culture, right? It doesn't actually have that much to do with being a Christian anyway. I'm going to move to a more permissive culture where, as one man told me when he was making that move, and I said, why? Why are you doing this? You know what he said to me? At least I don't have anybody telling me what to do. And so I go. And after all, it isn't going to change that much. They still obey all of Christ's commandments, this church does. They certainly will not go for anything evil or far out like divorce. Never. That would be wrong. And they only want to just get some of this man-made culture stuff out of the way. Missing the somewhat relevant point that it's absolutely impossible to escape culture, and that all culture is man-made? Anyway, I leave. The problem is now that the cultural threshold is lower than it was. And this new culture simply allows a lot more. And there are culture that allows, well, a whole lot of things. Not divorce, but a lot of other things. A lot of more things, and now I look more like the culture. I look more like the general society. I do a lot of things the general society does that I didn't do before. So I engage in all these things. Not evil things, necessarily. just more things, more cultural acculturation with the society around me. But in the process, I become a different person than I was before. See, there's this idea that we stand here and we make this decision. Now we move to this new position, but I'm still the same person making decisions. No, when you made that move, you became a different person now that's making decisions from a different perspective than you were making them from before, which is why you see people and they do this whole stair-step thing. Each time you move your frame of reference, which gives you a whole other view of the world. That's critical, and we often don't understand that. So the person changed the culture, the person changes. He now has a new personal identity, and the identity is, my new identity now is, if I feel restricted by your nonsense, I'll just leave. I don't have to put up with this. I'm tough. Anyway, it's all just man-made culture anyway. That's who I am, right? And then I run into trouble with this new culture. I thought they were a good bunch, but now I'm there, and there's some of the same hard-headed nonsense. First group, people holding on to culture ideas that don't have anything to do with Scripture, and it's just ridiculous. So I leave again, and I go to another group with an even lower cultural threshold. That group allows for more, and now I run into a problem. I've been dragging my wife from one place to another. She's sick of it, and she doesn't like the direction things are going, and we start having marriage problems. And so I sit down with my pastor, and he says, you know, it's really sad that this is happening. What we've discovered is some people really just aren't compatible. And I don't believe it's God's will for your life, for you to go through life unhappily married. So even while we recognize divorce is not ideal, it's even wrong, we recognize there's forgiveness for this. And this is the counsel he gives you. And in my moment of darkness, despair, and weakness, of which all lives have enough, I fall to the level of my chosen culture's allowance. I do not live up to what I say I believed. Now I'm in a culture where divorce is permitted. Now I have a new identity. I'm a fresh divorcee looking for God's perfect will for my new life's partner. That's a sad, sad story, friends. It's a really sad story. And next thing you know, 30 years have passed. You're sitting in this situation where I opened this scene with your phone pinging, your lawyer, your second wife, your lawyer trying to get the children, or who's going to take care of the children this weekend. You go back to your family reunion and you say, how did I get here? Culture was a big part of it. I'm not saying it was the only factor, but it was an awful big part of it. And you wonder, I wonder if I could just be shed of all this and just go home. Just start over. Maybe. But you are never taking your children back with you. You are never taking them back. And so somehow you got yourself into this irreparable situation. And identity and culture are major factors in the crash. Because culture is going to have a major effect on you. No matter what you do, it will. See, we might as well know what the ground rules for culture are. So here they are. The three great rules for culture. You can choose your culture. He's going to give this as a handout. Point number one, you can choose your culture, but you cannot choose the effects that culture will have on you. You can choose your culture, but you cannot choose the effect that culture will have on you. Rule number two, culture beats training and ideals. in moments of darkness, despair, and weakness, of which all lives have enough, you will fall to the level of your chosen culture's allowance, not fly at the level of your inspired belief or ideals. And point number three, since we will all be judged by our actions, and our actions will be shaped by our cultural expectations, to a large degree, when you choose your culture, you're choosing your eternal destiny. And then there's a sub-point. Even if you can somehow escape all that, the evil effects of your chosen culture, for example, you had an outstanding upbringing, your own children will be the average of your chosen culture's true values and practices. You simply cannot beat the system, and only a fool would try. You can and you will choose your culture, and then your culture will choose for you. Thank you.